the snow was falling on it.
Hey everybody, welcome to Comedy on Vinyl. This week we have a very special guest, Matt Besser, talking about his favorite Lenny Bruce album. Please make sure to follow Matt on Twitter, at Matt Besser, and to listen to and subscribe to his podcast, Improv for Humans. It's on the Earwolf Network. That's Improv, the number four, Humans. A very special thank you to Matt Besser for welcoming both Mike and I into his house. And an extra special thanks for welcoming me into his house 20 minutes later than Mike. I got a little lost. That is unlike me, but it happened, and we all have to deal with it. All of us, including you. I'm done. So, please listen to this episode and enjoy. And again, please make sure to subscribe, rate us highly, and do the same for, again, Matt's podcast, Improv for Humans.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And certainly nice to be here at the most famous theater in the world, the wonderful Palladium Theater. Ha ha ha. Well, folks, I just got back from Las Wages, Nevada. Funny thing about working Las Wages, folks, the way to make a lot of money there, when you get off the plane, walk right into the propeller. I tell you, funny thing happened, folks. This little pansy walked into the bar, and then into the motel jokes, the army jokes, the impressions, 10, 12, 15 minutes, and he's bombing nothing, but not left one. Now he goes into the dying jokes. Oh, well, folks, I wasn't born here, but I'm sure dying here. Ha! A lot of different ways to die, and blah, blah, blah. Now he starts with putting the audience down. Well, Freddie boy, I see it's little Squaresville. Little Squaresville for the first show. The greatest in them all. Oh, not the baby, that crap. Let's go to show business heaven. How about it, maestro, eh? How about it, maestro? Alec, electrician. Let's hit it, boys. I'll rock by my baby. Walks off, gets a little courtesy applause. Two people, sounds like Citizen Kane.
Terrible. All right, everybody. Hi, thanks for coming to Comedy on Vinyl. This week, we are speaking about the Lenny Bruce album, I Am Not a Nut, Elect Me. And this week, we have Mike Warden.
Hello.
And Matt Besser.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For having me.
Thank you for helping me get here. So, we just generally like to start, you know, what's so important about this album to you?
I think when you sent me the invitation to be on your show, you said influential, or did I just
yes.
make that up?
No, that's exactly what I said.
Which might be a different choice than favorite.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The order of my influence in stand-up vinyl would be my parents had all the Bill Cosby stuff, so that was my first stuff I listened to. I listened to every single Bill Cosby record. And that dominated my youth. And they had a Woody Allen record too. That was great. That was pretty much it in my memory of what my parents had. And I didn't really, as a kid, buy comedy records. I don't know if it occurred to me or not. But then it was Steve Martin, yeah. Like so many stand-ups in my generation would probably say. People my age would probably either say Richard Pryor or Steve Martin as their number one influence, and Steve Martin was probably more the direction I went. And then Andy Kaufman, who didn't really have a record, I don't think,
right.
But I his things that I saw in video probably influenced me more than anything. I was kind of blown away by that, but that wasn't until really when I was in college. But I have to say, when I learned about Lenny Bruce, which was college too, that was when I was starting to consider that stand-up comedy could actually be a career. Like, that never even occurred to me when I was in high school. I thought I was going to be an investment banker like my dad, and that's why I went to college. And I don't know even how I thought of it. I guess I thought that if you wanted to be a comedian or even in a band or something like that, you had to be from New York City or Los Angeles, sure, or like a city. And I was from Little Rock, Arkansas, so it didn't even occur to me that I could, as much as I love those things, it never even occurred to me that I had to write to be one of those things, which, yeah, is kind of odd.
Is that what you studied in school, in college?
Economics? Yeah. For about a half a semester until I realized how stupid I was compared to everybody else who was in the class. I was like, well, this obviously is not what I'm good at. I went to school at Amherst College up in Massachusetts, so that was also a whole different scene than the Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas I'd grown up in. So sure, my mind was being opened up in all sorts of ways. But I was an American Studies major, and I chose for my thesis Lenny Bruce.
Awesome.
So it gave me a great excuse to do nothing but listen to Lenny Bruce recordings. And I got just about every one of them on vinyl, except for this one, oddly enough, mm-hmm, which may be my favorite. I have it on cassette. But all of his stuff is pretty amazing. And the story of Lenny Bruce, what he did, is pretty amazing. I picked I'm Not a Nut, which it's not like, I'm not even sure if any of the ones, the bits here, were any of the bits that he got arrested for. My guess is no. And in this one doesn't necessarily have the most of my favorite Lenny Bruce bits.
Sure.
But it has the one where he starts to talk about just the business of being a stand-up,
uh-huh,
and comedy and censorship itself. And he talks about the process of comedy. And I think when I was listening to that in college, that was fascinating to me. I never heard that, even if this guy was, you know, four decades before me. And so much, right, of the humor is referential and you can't understand it. But right, I could understand that, or be fascinated by that. And there's one bit in particular, the Palladium,
mm-hmm,
which is probably half of the recording.
Yeah.
It's probably a 30-minute bit, if, yeah, not a 20-minute bit. But that is one of his classic bits, and that is one of my favorites. We can just talk about that bit, I guess.
Sure.
But that bit is about a stand-up who's doing all the, you know, sleazy stand-up joints, which in those days were strip clubs or the backs of a bar.
And that's what he was doing,
Vegas,
right?
Yeah, so the stuff he was doing, or at least definitely where he started.
Mm-hmm.
And that stand-up gets a little tired of that scene. He's like, I'm ready to take it to the next level. And he wants to do the Palladium in London, which is like the biggest showcase, live showcase there is. And as his manager says, that's not your scene, man. That's vaudeville. He's like, nah, that's the next level. So I'm not going to just repeat his whole bit. Basically, he goes to London and he bombs three times. And then in the third time, there's two funny things about it. One, he has to follow this woman who does this dedication to all the dead soldiers, all the English soldiers who have died in wars, and then brings him out, which is like the worst thing that an entertainer can go through.
Uh-huh.
And he has to follow that, and he bombs again. But this time, to get himself out of bombing, he starts going, fuck the Irish, you know, screw the Irish. And that gets the London crowd loving him, going, yeah, screw the Irish. So where they were just giving him nothing, all of a sudden they start going crazy. And that's, before I was a performer, that was an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
Once you become a performer, it's even a more interesting story, I think, because I've gone through that exact thing. Mm-hmm. When I was doing stand-up in Chicago, I once had to follow this guy who ended his act. He was a black comedian. He ended, and he was really funny, but he ended his act by saying, "Before I go, I'd just like to tell you a story. I volunteer with mentally handicapped kids on the weekend, and this weekend I was over speaking to one of those kids, and he said, 'Edmund, why is your skin brown and my skin's white?' And I told him, 'You know, some people are brown and some people are white, and that's just how it is.' And then the little boy said, 'Well, why can't I be brown?' And I said, 'Well, you know, you were born white and I'm born brown, and that's just the way it is.' And the little boy said to me, 'I wish everybody could be all the colors of the rainbow so we would all get along. Good night, everybody.'"
Oh,
and then introduced me. And he did that to me a couple of times. And he was a funny guy, but that's just like leaving the next guy in a hole, like getting all sentimental.
So was he doing that on purpose, like to make himself laugh? Was it?
No. I'm not going to give him that much credit. He was doing it to get people to go, "Oh, what a good guy," kind of clapping as he went off, you know. Like, not only did we laugh tonight, but we all learned a lesson. Which is that, you know, that same false sentimentality and that Lenny Bruce brings up and he has to follow. And another interesting thing about that is that bit is kind of a metaphor for him in that what people really loved about him was at the end, if they could boil him down to something, he was the word back then was sick comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would call like a shock, I guess is what the word we use now, but he's a sick, crazy comedian. At the end, like really what they just wanted him to do is say cocksucker or tits or shit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like yelling screw the Irish. So in
right.
a way that was a metaphor for his own career that just at the end it was just let's go see him curse and get arrested.
Right.
Instead of really talk about stuff.
So how long was it then for you after stand-up that sketch became a thing for you? I mean, for those who don't know who are listening, Matt, obviously you started the UCB with three other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Correct? Okay. So how long after stand-up then did it become sketch?
In my own career?
Yeah.
Well, I started doing stand-up right after I did it in college a little bit, enough to get the bug, and then I went to Denver or the Boulder area right after college because a friend of mine was there. And then I went to Chicago because of the boom. There was a ton of clubs in Chicago. And I didn't even know what improv was. I went and saw this place at the Improv Olympic. I saw Tim Meadows and Chris Farley and Kevin Dorff, a lot of the funny guys go up and do this thing called an improvised herald. And that blew me away. So that's the transition. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but yeah, the plan wasn't to get in sketch. And bringing it back to Lenny Bruce, what people that only casually know Lenny Bruce's material or what they've read might think that he was always just kind of talking about society and semantics, but really that's only the latter part of his career once he started getting busted. Before that, like this album, he's just talking about everything and doing a lot of characters, really. Mm-hmm. Like just every one of his bits, he does multiple character voices.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's really, people talk about that enough.
I'm a hustler. As long as they give, I'll grab. But I know that someday there's going to have a tribunal. We'll all have to answer, I'm sure of that. I'm just waiting for the day. I'm saving some money to give back. I know I was stealing. I didn't mean to take it. They gave it to me. We'll all have to answer. They'll line us up. The guy will be in the black shrouds. All the performers. All right, line them up. All the offenders there. State their names and their salaries. The sentences will be then meted out. The first offender, what is your name there? Frankie Lane. How much do you make a week, Mr. Lane? $10,000 to $12,000 a week. It's remarkable. What do you do to earn from $10,000 to $12,000 a week? To spend one, burn his wig. Break his legs, 30 years in jail. Get them up here, the next one.
What is your name?
Sophie Tucker. And how much do you make a week, Miss Tucker?
$20,000 to $30,000 a week.
What do you do to earn $20,000 to $30,000 a week? I'm the last of the red hot. Burn her Jewish records and jellies and the crepe gowns with the sweat under the arm. Get rid of her. Get them up here, the next one.
Before he became the comedian that he became, who just spoke honestly, he was like so many comedians, he was an impressionist. Like he calls the guy Frank Dell. Frank Dell, master impressionist. You know, he's saying that kind of disparagingly, because those guys would just go, here's Bela Lugosi ordering Chinese food or whatever. Yeah. They would just do an impression and not much comment, and that's what he did too.
Yeah.
So he was adept and really good at voices and going back and forth. This is a whole stand-up skill in itself. So in a way, he is a sketch performer.
Sure.
And it was only in retrospect that I was like, you know what? I think that's one of the things I really liked about him, that he was kind of pretty much doing sketches by himself. There's a bit on this album called The Defiant Ones, which is really a sketch. I mean, that's what it is. He does it with the guy, Eric Miller, this guy in his jazz band. And he did, throughout his career, a couple of bits with Eric Miller. There's actually a better bit even called...
is it the one, How to Make Colored People Comfortable?
At How to Make Colored People Relax.
That's what it is,
At your party.
that one's one of the classics and really funny. This one's pretty funny, too. It's a parody of the movie The Defiant Ones. Mm-hmm. But it's just a straight-up sketch on a stand-up album. And I think, especially for this time, how many people did that? I can't think of another stand-up album that has just a sketch all of a sudden like that from this time period.
Right. I mean, the other people who were doing characters, like somebody like Bill Cosby, like you mentioned earlier, it still wasn't a sketch. It was a long, long, long story. They weren't defined voices. They were sort of...
Right, and he didn't have another person join him
exactly.
either. Jonathan Winters and all those guys did it by themselves, but I can't remember anyone going, and now someone's going to join me and do a bit. So that it seems like if he had been around 10 years later, he would have just been in a sketch group, maybe.
Right.
Maybe.
I hadn't heard a lot of his character stuff until the last few years, because when I was in college, I was introduced through women's studies classes. That
really?
So I heard the most obscene that they could get, which wasn't really character based stuff. It was just like straightforward, and that's all I would listen to was like 3 or 4 snippets. And it wasn't until recently that I actually started listening to more of his stuff, and I didn't realize how character based it is. It's wonderful.
And it's interesting because some of the people we've talked to on the show, like even the regulars that we've spoken to, they're hesitant to bring up Lenny Bruce because to them they're like, he's not really a stand-up. And I would disagree with that. I think people know
he's not really a stand-up.
Yeah.
How did they say that?
I think they consider him, or how they really put it, maybe not so much not a stand-up, but they just generally didn't find him all that funny, which is. I think, again, they're judging him based on the later stuff, where he was just sitting there reading court transcripts.
Well, there's a couple of problems, and you have to listen to it with a historical ear a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, one, there are just a ton of references that would go by over anybody's head that isn't, like, into that era big time. But to me, you get the gist of what he's talking about. Even when he's saying references, you don't really have to know the reference to understand the overall bit. Even like on this album, the Esther Costello story, that's like a specific movie that was out that year that he's making fun of. But you still get that the movies, he sets it up, he's like, it's about a blind and deaf girl who's blind and deaf this whole movie, and it's this real sad movie, and at the end of the movie... she gets brutally raped, and all of a sudden she's not deaf or blind anymore. And he's like, what kind of moral is that? And he takes, and that's funny, he takes like 5 minutes to say what I said in a minute.
Right.
And you might get lost. But, or he has this other bit about calling up to get calling up 411 to get a phone number. And it's just a simple observation that Jerry Seinfeld probably made.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like if you call more than once, you feel like changing your voice because you feel like an idiot. That's just a simple comedic premise. But people have to realize that people didn't really talk like that and do stand up like that before Lenny. So as a stand up, people should appreciate that. Like, there's so many things where people are like, ah, that's. You could even listen to Lenny Bruce thing and go, oh, that's hack. And it's like, yeah, it is hack, but he did it first.
Right, right.
And people just don't get it. He set up so much of this basic structure for how stand-ups do stand-up. So to say he's not a stand-up is absurd.
It's a lot more
casual. To say I don't relate to it, I can get.
Sure. Yeah.
You got to concentrate. It's a little intimidating sometimes. You really have to be, like, focused on it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a lot more casual approach to the audience, and I don't know, again, I don't know what your stand-up was like, but did any of that influence you? I mean...
Oh, no, if you're saying that I do stand-up like Lenny Bruce, not at all. but, yeah, that's what... It wasn't an influence of, like, I want to get up there, man, and really dig it, you know? I wasn't, if anything, the first time I went up, everybody thought I was doing Bobcat Goldthwait because I was so nervous. I was stuttering and my arms were shaking and I had this crazy, loud, nervous energy. And people thought it was funny. You know, and I pretended that it was on purpose, you know, all that nervous energy. And that kind of became my character for a while, which is nothing like Lenny Bruce at all. But to me, it was more the influence was, especially being in college before I was doing it at that point, was, holy shit, like a stand-up was a historical figure. Like he, the way we think about censorship in art today, he was the forefront of that.
Yeah.
He was the middle of that, and that was a stand-up comedian. I think that's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
The only guy we have to compare that to now would be Howard Stern.
Right.
Who is another hero of mine, and I think he's really cool. And, like, to take just a snippet of Howard Stern, you wouldn't listen to it and go, that's genius, the way you would a Woody Allen bit or a Steve Martin bit or whatever, but you have to kind of take the overall, you know, the overall body of work and what it means and what Howard has done for censorship and freedom of speech and being able to speak comedically with freedom and not be repressed. And I think it went from Lenny Bruce pretty much to him, you know?
Sure.
And there were some guys in the middle like Richard Pryor, Sam Kinison, but I think you can almost point to, or Eddie Murphy, I think you can almost point to some of the stuff they did as setting back doing stuff that was offensive and not intelligent.
Right.
Like when Eddie Murphy does Ralph... one of them fucking the other one up the ass.
We just did that record a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it's like, as a kid, I laughed, but like, as an adult, look back, I'm like, that's just homophobic, simple hack bullshit.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take away from the genius of the rest of the album.
Sure. Especially for being however old
but
he
then,
was at the time.
What's that?
Especially for being however old he was at the time, the rest of it was pretty damn good.
Right, but... So people could say that's offensive and maybe be right, and then but then you point to Lenny Bruce, and he was able to defend every bit he did.
Sure.
He could talk about, you know, gay people and make fun of gay people, but do it in a more intelligent, empathetic way.
Sure. It wasn't judgmental. There was nothing judgmental about what he did unless it was judgmental against being a bigot.
Right.
It seemed to be, you know.
Just more smart. Like, he had this bit about... And he says faggot over and over in a way no one could do that today because you would think there was hatred behind the words.
Right.
But when he did it, you didn't feel that. Because he was saying kike or nigger the next sentence. So you didn't feel like, oh, he hates. You knew that wasn't going on. But his bit was something about faggots, man. There's no one braver than a faggot. Like, you know, these guys just go up to each other in the movie theater and just lean over and start jacking each other out. Now, that's bravery. That's courage. Let's put those guys in the army. That's real courage. You don't see any straight guys doing that. They'd get their ass kicked, you know. And I don't think that's a hateful...
No.
But, you know, it depends where... And that was such a big point of his, you know, that became his thing, was saying it's context, it's how you present it, and what's behind the word, not the word itself. And, you know, the whole Michael Richards thing, he would have been saying, hold on, Laugh Factory, don't say you can't say the word nigger, that's crazy.
Yeah.
You just can't have a racist on your stage. There's a difference between... Don't say the word and don't allow a racist on your stage.
Yeah.
And he would have been smart enough to explain that and do a funny bit. But so many intelligent comedians were just like, don't say the word and we're going to stop doing it. And we're heroes for doing that.
Yeah.
It's the word's the problem. It's like, come on.
But unfortunately, most comics say, well, that's the drunk to do, and they all do that drunk. And they don't see that kind of drunk. The drunks that they don't report are cafe drunks that they see time and time again. I call them white-collar drunks. Now, the best part of these guys is not when they're in the club watching a show, is when they first come in, because they're really juiced out of their nut. But they drugged it. They don't want to be associated with drunks, and they just walk extra cool when they work. So no one knows they're loaded, they think. They're impeccably dressed always, clean-shaven, buff nails whacked out of their skull. You think I'm drunk, don't you? No, mister, you're perfectly sober. Goddamn right I am. Listen right there. Hey, why don't you stop wiping those glasses for a minute, will you, and listen to me? Or do you want some trouble, Want a little trouble, glass wiper, huh?
It seems like they've missed a whole lot. I mean, were you a fan of George Carlin? I mean, after this? I mean...
I was.
I mean, he went out of his way to not be compared to Lenny Bruce, understandably, because they're not the same kind of comics.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I guess my question is it okay if... should there be any conflict between being a funny person and being important? Because a lot of people find a conflict, you know, or, you know, just let him be a comic. He doesn't need to be saying important things, or... I know how I feel.
Wait, say it again? Do you have to say important things to be a comic?
No, I'm saying, do you... people try and make it exclusive, mutually. You have to either be funny or be saying something important or something intelligent. And it seems to me, and again, people just, I think that's what puts some people off of somebody like Lenny Bruce, where he's being offensive, he's also being brilliantly funny, but he's also saying something important, and some people get turned off by that. And I guess my question is, why? Why do you think that might be?
That's a deep question right there.
It's a little convoluted, actually, that's a better way to put it.
Well, first off, a lot of people might know Lenny Bruce. My first intro to him was Lenny, the Dustin Hoffman movie, which was brilliant. And if you watch that, you get the impression that all, like I was saying earlier in this interview, all he did was talk about semantics.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of that, and some of his most brilliant bits are that, like that bit, to come.
Mm-hmm.
Come.
Yeah, yeah, come.
To, preposition, come as a verb. I think those are the bits that people know him. That's just a fucking satirical bit about language and censorship and freedom of speech. It's just a real heady bit. But that, I think that's what most people know him for, and that's not all his work. And then in the end, all he did was read his court transcripts and just kind of do commentary on him. But,
he became really obsessed with that, it seemed.
Yeah. I mean, cause that was his whole life, but, and I'm pretty sure there's not much, if any, concert footage of him besides that. So I think, unfortunately, that's what he becomes known for, but really that's a small part of what his body of work was about. It wasn't all about that. I try to think who are other comedians that are considered, what word are we using here? Important or
I guess influential.
And yeah, what other ones would you say like that? Like I don't think of him as necessarily being like, if someone would go, he's a political comedian, I'd be like, no, he wasn't. Right. I mean, he did talk about political stuff and racism, but he wasn't Mort Saul, who was, right. was his contemporary. That was the, he was the political comedian.
He makes a crack about him on this album.
He makes a crack about Shelley Berman, too. And I've heard, I think he had a thing with Shelley Berman, which I wish I knew more about. Because he's always kind of thrown out his name, but I've never really understand what he didn't like about him.
It seems almost every comedian lists Lenny Bruce as an influence, and then trying to look up stuff, I can't find people who Lenny Bruce ever said influenced him, like his direct influences. I was having a tough time, but I didn't read his book. Did you read his autobiography?
No, I haven't.
I've never read his autobiography, so.
His autobiography is half bullshit, for one. How to influence people. I've talked dirty and influence people. Like, half of it's made up. Mm-hmm. But the Albert Goldman biography is brilliant. It's a great book if you're really interested. But, who would his... Since he pretty much changed stand-up... There was no one like him. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people say one of his friends who wasn't a comedian was his biggest influence. I forget the guy's name. And there's a lot of comedians who could say that. Like, I think there's a lot of comedians who have that funny friend they grew up with who was funny and never became a comedian, but was very influential in their sense of humor. And Lenny Bruce definitely had that guy in his life. Mm-hmm. It's just a shame I can't remember his name. But other than that, it was all cheesy, kind of jokey, you know, Henny Youngman type humor. It was either jokes or impressions. It wasn't people just speaking honestly about stuff.
It must have been freeing to be able to find something else to talk about, but then at the same time to be sort of slapped around for talking about something different besides the old shit. I just can't imagine what that feels like. And I feel like there aren't any stand-ups who... nowadays who have anything comparable to deal with. There's not much to deal with, is there?
What do you mean?
No outside influence other than just your life, spouting your life out on stage, maybe finding a character and doing something. But, I mean, he had, you know, politics to deal with. He had people, he had the FBI, he had everybody else, you know, trying to clap down on him. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like we have that.
Well, what we do have, interestingly enough, is... what has happened to Michael Richards, what happened to Tracy Morgan, mm-hmm. Is technology going to start censoring comedians? And then what happened to Patton Oswalt recently, too, a stand-up comedian. He was doing a set at basically, not an open mic show, but a small show at a restaurant or something. And a member of the audience started taping him, and he was like, stop taping me. Mm-hmm. And then they got into it, he went after her like you'd go after a heckler.
Sure.
And then a fellow stand-up the next day wrote a blog, you know, calling him an asshole. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't want to lump Tracy Morgan, Michael Richards, and Patton all together, but it's like... Now we have people in the audience with their cell phones who can now take a piece of material out of context, mm-hmm. or even not the material, just have their opinion online on Twitter immediately. Mm-hmm. Like it just happened to Dane Cook. So I'm listing like four or five examples of cell phones or Twitter or social networking commenting on a stand-up immediately, and the stand-up... in the worst case, ruining his life with Michael Richards.
Yeah.
A little less than that, Tracy Morgan affecting his career. Sure. Not ruining it, but definitely him being slapped around and having to make apologies and bullshit. Patton, in his case, not affecting his career, but him having to deal with bullshit online for a week. Yeah. Same with Dane Cook. So it definitely affects people. It affects the next way they're going to do material the next time they're up. Or maybe it doesn't. That just depends how they're going to deal with this new type of censorship. But it is kind of, it's not from the government. It's from our own fans.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. Or our fellow comedians.
For you, I mean, have you ever experienced anything like that? I mean, I know you don't. I mean, do you still do stand-up? Or are you still exclusively, I know you do shows. I do know you do.
I don't know if you call it stand-up. I do solo. I go up solo and do characters,
right,
or do what I would call bits.
Mm-hmm.
Have I been affected by this, what I'm calling technological censorship? I don't think so. I mean, I've done stuff before where I'm always going after the Pope and the child molestation stuff in the Catholic Church. I just think it's crazy.
Yeah.
And I think it's crazy how people don't talk about it. I think it's crazy how people call themselves Catholics don't do more about it.
Yeah.
So I'm always making fun of that. And I was doing a bit one, I think I was being the Nazi Pope and doing a bit about it. And in the bit, talking about how Hispanic Catholics in particular are crazy on the down low and no one will admit to being gay in that culture,
mm-hmm,
which is dead on fact. And this Hispanic Catholic in the crowd threw a chair at me on stage.
Really?
What?
Yeah. So it definitely riled him up enough to get violent. And then,
wow,
I didn't break character, but I taunted him a lot about that.
Religion is definitely something that people kind of go off. And I think that's one of the reasons that people single Lenny Bruce out so much for the obscenity stuff was the religious.
Yeah, they say when he got busted in Chicago, that is what it was about. They might have pointed to the obscenities as,
mm-hmm,
the reason, but they say him going after the Catholic Church in a town like Chicago was his biggest mistake.
Yeah.
And that's what the cops were saying when they were busting him.
He even does that bit, though, on there about how it's going to offend the Jews. So, you know, we think it's probably going to offend, we think it'll offend the Gentiles, too.
Yeah. He does this bit about going on the Steve Allen Show, which is another behind-the-scenes stand-up and talking about censorship, which is fascinating me, about going on the show. And it sounds like a story that Bill Hicks would have told about Letterman,
yeah,
or Louis C.K. could tell about going on Letterman or Conan today,
mm-hmm,
about how they go through your bit, you know, the guys on the shows, they still do that, and they examine every bit for who it could possibly offend. And it's not just words. It can, like, this particular bit was about you can't get buried in a Jewish cemetery if you have a tattoo.
Steve Allen's got a very hip sense of humor, and he cracks up at everything I'm doing. Producer Bill Harbeck is hip, but he's got a little more to lose. So he gives these kind of laughs, like, ha ha, gee, yeah. You know. Now I went into a bit they didn't let me do on the Allen Show. I have a tattoo. It's not a cockamamie or anything, it doesn't rub off. Because of this tattoo, I never can be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's the Orthodox scene. You have to go out of the world the way you came in. No marks, no changes, which certainly disobeys the rabbi philosophy. I don't know where that swings. I got back from Malta, so I'm over at my aunt's house in Jamaica, Long Island. I'm in the kitchen, I'm washing with a Roki soap. She pins the tattoo. So she looks and she flips. She went, "Vah! Vah!" She's a real Jewish seagull, you know what I'm saying? Look at you then. You ruined your arm. You can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. I said, "Mima, what are you nudging me? They'll cut this off. They'll bury this in a Gentile cemetery." Like, all right? Okay. Now, the guy says to me, "You can't do that joke." Why not?
So his suggestion was, well, I only have a tattoo on my arm, so bury all my body in the Jewish cemetery except for my arm. Bury that in a Christian cemetery. And they're like, well, that's offensive to the Jews. And he's like, no, it's not. And then they took a day to think about it, and they came back, and they're like, you know, Lenny, we thought about it, and It's definitely offensive to the Christians, too, because that implies Christians will bury anything in their cemeteries. So, there's no cursing there. It's based upon a fact that Jews have that silly thing in their religion about tattoos. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wasn't making fun of Christians. That's just looking to be offended kind of thing. So, it points out the absurdity of censorship.
Yeah.
And it's crazy how... I bet you could still... You could do that joke without problem right now on TV, but I bet they'd look over it a few times still.
Yeah, yeah.
And think about it.
Well, there's a couple of people, like Tim Minchin currently, who's really pushing his atheistic comedy. Everything is about religion with him, and it's all about atheism, and he can't get anything on American TV for the most part. He's been on a ton of podcasts. He's got specials, but he can't get on anything.
Interesting. I guess it scares people, but at the end of the day, the bottom line is what's in the way of speaking your piece a little bit. I mean, there's... I don't know.
I had another question. They seem so fluid, Lenny Bruce's stuff, to come back to this. Every bit seems so fluid. Was it all written, or was mm-hmm. there a level of improv? No, there wasn't.
Not much. I don't know if he says it on this one or another one I was listening to, but he even speaks to that. Actually, it wasn't this one. It's another one he's talking about. These bits really... written out, people think I'm ad-libbing, but I ad-lib at most like 10 to 15 words per bit. That's right. So, no. These are well thought out bits. If you hear him do them on different versions, they're like, yeah, that's pretty much the same way. Another interesting thing about the Palladium bit, which I didn't find out until I was improvising, Del Close was a contemporary of Lenny Bruce, and he is the mentor of the Upright Citizens Brigade. He's one of the original Second City committee guys who invented the way we do improv today. And he told us a story of when Lenny Bruce was working this bit up, was first working on this bit, the Palladium, about the stand-up who goes to the big show in London. Del was in the audience with his friend Frank, and that's how the character name came. Lenny Bruce is out there and he sees both of them together, so when it comes time in the bit to name the comedian, he goes, Frank Del.
And that
became the bit. So that's such a kismet weird thing for me that in college I would love this particular bit so much, and then eventually the guy's named after becomes my mentor. It's a very small world weirdness there.
You're going to have to put a cover of this, a photo of this up on.
Oh, I know. It has to go up.
This is just an amazing cover.
It's insane.
It is. Holy shit. I want to buy that from you. Do you think they have that cover? Do they have that other album? Do they have another one of those?
They might. You can have this one.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, no. Not at all.
They've got a good selection of stuff at the Counterpoint, right next to the theater. There.
His first album, which I have, is The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce.
I've never heard that one. And they have a bunch of those at the store, and I've wanted to buy
this one. It shows him in eating a picnic layout on a grave in a graveyard, and that was just considered crazy back then.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even pretty sick now, but then
that
was considered just outlandish.
What year is that album?
I'm going to guess 1957 or 56.
Of course it doesn't, so it's definitely old.
Wow.
I was actually thinking about this, listening through this, and then again realizing how much he depended on voices. Listening to your stuff in podcasts and seeing you online and in your sketches, as far as your voices, a lot of them, you've got some similar intonation sometimes when you do voices. I mean, does that come out intentionally, or is there...
Definitely not. I think that's the Jewish gene, if anything.
Because there's an English voice on here that he does. It's very similar to one you were doing on, I can't remember what, probably Comedy Bang Bang the other day. But yeah, like, almost spot on.
And that's true. What's really impressive, and I wish I've challenged myself to do, and I really haven't, is how he goes back and forth so quickly between the voices.
Mm-hmm.
That's a difficult skill.
It is, and he utilizes the different intonation microphone too. Like he would pull it away, you hear it louder. Mm-hmm.
He does that a lot.
So you really have to. I really say it to say it. I have to focus. I was trying to listen to this last weekend on the treadmill, and I'm running, and there's like TVs around me and stuff, and I'm like, I couldn't. I was like, no.
And he does a lot of bits where he kind of just have half sentences, and where he just kind of ends, and you just kind of have to be in the flow, and you know where he's going. You just have to know. It's like you fill in the blank, like you know what the guy's thinking.
Yeah.
I think that's.
That's a lot of the charm of it, and I love listening to. I cannot remember the album that I first heard. It had some bits of this, so it might have been a compilation. Actually, now that I think about it.
But. Yeah, the I almost chose the one that's called the what's it called the bits that got me arrested or whatever.
Oh, yeah,
that has. If you're gonna get one Lenny Bruce, you probably get that one
because
it is all the famous bits. Carnegie Hall is also just fascinating. Because it was such a big night for him.
Yeah.
And there is stuff that's a little more extemporaneous in there.
I love the writing on this one. It says, if you value your license and reputation, do not air this record. Obscene, not for air.
I know, that's from... Well, that's from my from my radio station. I stole these records from. But yeah, those are warnings from. It's like we have this record, but you can't play it. And that's the 1990.
And I try not to harp on this too much because people get annoyed with it. But the physicality of having a record. I mean, did you every time we talk to somebody, usually they've got a moment where they just sat down with the headphones and a record player and just listened. And just had an experience with themselves and the record. I mean, is that part of... Maybe not this album, but I mean, can you relate to that?
That's interesting.
When I say a moment with yourself, it sounded a little creepier than I actually...
It's funny, by the time that I was fantasizing about being a comedian myself, I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly when CDs... was starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
So in the way I think you're saying, like I sat down and would look at a Woody Allen thing and would go one day or something like that. Like, I don't know if I had that moment. Like to me, I like these cassettes you see here, I got these on the streets of Boston. And to me, there was something more, what's the word, contraband or something cool about the, like, Lenny Bruce cassette that I can't find in vinyl that I could only find in a cassette on the street in a city. So, or in St. Mark's Place and, you know, in New York City or something like that. So, that might have had more of a punk rock feel versus my record collection. Like I said, it was all, it's, I still have every... comedy record that I've ever bought, but it would be all my parents, Bill Cosby's, and then once I got to college, I was getting funny ones. Like I got this one here called "The Undernourished Comedian Frankie Scott, You're in My Act," a hilarious comedy party album recorded live for adults only, and it's just fucking. All these jokes about being skinny.
Oh, God. Amazing.
And I got another one called Sam Levinson, But Seriously, Folks. And that one's just family comedy. And it's about, this is comedy anyone in the family can listen to. I got Freddie Prinze, Dick Gregory, Firesign Theater, Flip Wilson.
Oh, what Woody Allen?
Woody Allen.
That's the one I have. That's the one I bought. We haven't done that one yet. Doesn't have a name.
So that one's great.
It's really good.
Does it have recipes on the back?
Recipes
yes.
on the back.
Yes.
It's great.
It is a lost art form. Again, I won't harp on it, but, you know, you get to play with it a little bit more. There's, you got, you know, I guess CDs, you can have more liner notes and all that.
All mine were
records. Now, I mean, even CDs are disappearing.
Yeah.
People are... Which I think is a shame. Mm-hmm. I mean, this thing of just doing stuff digitally, I think it just stuff just disappears
yeah.
to the ether. I feel like songs that I buy on iTunes, like, they just disappear the next time I get a computer or something. Like, I'm
right.
just always, it's like, oh, stick it in the cloud. It's like, it's not the same to me.
No.
I do want to hold it in my hand on some level.
Yeah. I feel like people are losing something, especially with comedy, because you don't feel like you own it. You don't have, again, you don't have a thing to latch onto. If you can't go see it, you need to have it, at least for me, I needed to have it in person,
mm-hmm.
in my hand. That was why I loved to listen to George Carlin and, you know, have something physical.
Now, if I can only straighten out Governor Long. He doesn't want to listen to me. I would have had him over, but he won't dress, you know. Just sits in his pajamas, won't put his teeth in or anything. He's sitting cursing at his wife, running around, making speeches in motels. He's really a delight, though. He really cracked me up. He had the greatest political campaign of any public figure. I saw him on television. Dig his political platform. I'm not a nut. What is that, right? No honesty, better schools. I'm not a nut. That's all I got. So I don't wet the bed, elect me. That's all. Forget it. Governor Long is really a sign of our times. How did the governor get out? He fired the people who put him in. Go fight that kind of action. You're a nut. You're fired.
I only had records growing up because my parents had a huge record collection. So I was all the Cosby stuff. And the stuff that I wasn't allowed to listen to was locked in a liquor cabinet, which was the Richard Pryor. I wasn't
mm-hmm.
able to listen to. Of course, we...
Because of the dirty words,
yeah,
for the most
yeah.
part. Okay.
Just in the same way we got into the liquor cabinet for the liquor, we also got into the liquor cabinet for the records, too. But I bought records when I was in college because they were a lot cheaper at the local store. I could buy a record for $1.
Yeah.
And I got to buy a CD for $20 at the time. It was before the press had even come down because the CDs were just...
Yeah.
ridiculous, but...
Is, I don't know, do you see any possibility for a resurgence in this kind of thing for exactly the reason we're talking about, where people might possibly want, I mean, I know some people do limited releases on vinyl and all that stuff. I went to a recording the other night that they're only going to release on vinyl.
Jonah Ray?
Yeah, I was there the other night, so, and
he's doing it almost like it's, like that's what's partly funny about it.
Yeah.
It's released on vinyl.
There's definitely part of it.
Well,
I'll tell you, I got... You guys made me bring this Technics back out from the garage. I mean, that's where it's been for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
Danielle's like, why are you bringing that out? My wife. And I'm like, because I want to listen to my records. She's like, but you never listen to your records. I'm like, I know, because it's in the garage.
Awesome.
So it got me to listen to some stuff I hadn't listened to in a while. And there's a couple of bands that only release on vinyl,
yeah.
and they've given me records which have just sat in my closet for the last 2 years, and now I finally can listen to their music. So you guys definitely brought me back to the vinyl.
That's awesome. Pretty funny.
The problem with, in my life, and it's a silly thing to say, but there aren't a lot of flat surfaces in my house to put a heavy Technics record player down
yeah.
on.
It's definitely a commitment to of space you have to make.
It is. And the storage of the vinyl is, too. I think probably everybody has a water damage or sunlight story
mm-hmm.
if they're vinyl collectors.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a shame. There's certain guys in music, like Steve Albini, who are very adamant about keeping vinyl around just because... a belief that it's better sound quality, even.
Right.
Once you get past the snaps and pops.
Well, I mean, some of these are beautiful sounding. Some of the I found a few. I think this one was in pretty good shape, even though I heard a skip on it last night. I was listening to the MP3 and it was skipping like crazy. But, yeah, no, I love that. And it's important to me just as in comedy, although, again, comedy albums are cheaper.
I just love the
else.
Physical, whether it's CD or record. I love having the physical in my hand. Like, I still rue the day that I went and took my CDs out of their jewel cases and put them in books So now I've got 6 books, and I hate that now. When I buy a new CD, I've got to shift the entire album over, and then so I can throw another A in there.
You have to alphabetize
them? I do.
That's a mental problem beyond.
But I need the physical thing, and I'll throw it on my computer, and now I have it. But when my computer dies, guess what? I still have the album. I don't have to put it in the cloud or pay money or whatever.
We sound like old men.
Right? I just love it. I love the physical copy.
I don't want to keep you much longer, but as far as, you know, if you were to leave people, because, you know, one of the reasons we do this is so that people listen to stuff they've never heard of, mm-hmm. or they never would have thought to listen to, why would you say listen to this album?
I guess if it's to learn about Lenny Bruce, it might not be this album. It might mm-hmm. be the one that is called... What I Was Arrested For. Because that has all the famous bits and probably even more of his classic bits. But, so I'm working my way out of your question. I'm not sure I would. Because you guys asked me what was my most influential.
Sure.
So, I guess I would recommend it maybe to someone who's fascinated by the history of comedy.
Yeah.
And that's why I think this is... It's something he talks a lot about. That bit, the Palladium, I just think is a classic bit.
Yeah.
That needs to be listened to. And then I think these other bits are just really show off his character work. Like he does that one, the white collared drunks, which is just a very simple. Like he wouldn't have been arrested for that,
right?
And but you know what? He could do that on TV today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's just all about. It's just a very simple observation that when people mostly do drunks, they do the typical back alley fall down red nose drunk.
Yeah,
and he does the white collar wine drunk.
Yeah,
it's just a different kind of specific drunk. Anyone can relate to that, you know. What is it? 50 years later, you could do that on TV tonight and just do it really well, like he does it. Or you could do it lame and not be that good. So as a sketch guy who's not really a stand up, I think this is a cool stand to look at that most people wouldn't think. You think Jonathan Winters when you think stand up and sketch. You don't think Lenny Bruce.
That's a really good point.
Or you think Robin Williams or Billy Crystal or those guys or Dana Carvey, you know, but Lenny Bruce, you think straight ahead talker talking about politics, and which really isn't entirely what he was at all. Maybe most famously what he was, but not entirely what he was. So he did so much for stand-up just in general.
I think art in general, like across the board, he's done so much.
Because
without his obscenity trial and what he did, then, yeah, like you said earlier, where would we be with a lot of this stuff?
Yeah, it's good to have that to look back on if somebody tries to shut you down. Not that I've had that happen, but, you know, if I were lucky enough to have somebody try and shut me down, it would be good to have this as a backup, I think.
And it's not only just, when you mean shut you down, you mean, like, you can't say that?
Yeah.
It also should be something to think about what you maybe shouldn't say. Or, like, just be smarter about what you do say when you do. To me, this era's of comedy's nigger is gay people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a lot of people saying the word faggot, necessarily. Mm-hmm. There is some, but I don't think there's... I think more the problem is jokes. The punchline is just, and he was gay.
Yeah.
And he sucked a cock. And that's just the whole punchline. And that's homophobic and hateful. And people, we should be offended by that.
Yeah.
People should think of the semantics of how you use the word gay.
Right.
And that's the type of stuff that Lenny Bruce talked about, too. It wasn't just, we should be... free to say anything. You got to see the other side of the coin, too. It's like, in a good context. Because I think, this is actually pretty interesting. The obscenity law comes down to, It's like 4 points. One is it trying to create lustful intent in the audience, right? So that's one thing. The other one, is it offensive by the community standard? Mm-hmm. Which, as he pointed out, in the area of San Francisco where he got busted, there were strip bars on every side of him. So that community, can he say that his words were creating more lust than the actual tits and ass around him? Of course not. Wait a minute, what got me into this? What were you just talking about that got me into this?
The 4 points of the
observer. No, right before that.
Shutting down?
Yes. Yeah, using words
responsibly. Oh, the judge said, he said, if the words offensive words have to prove that it has at least some redeemable intent. And the judge ruled that his did, and Lee Bruce is like, I don't want that to be what gets me off. I think the whole thing is redeemable. So you're basically saying it's all shit except for a little piece. And he's like, fuck that. That gives everybody a right just to come out and be dumbasses and pretend to be smart for it, and then it's okay. He's like, I don't want to represent that. Yeah. Everything I'm saying is smart.
Yeah.
So don't act like I'm just coming up here going shit, fuck, tit, ass. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is when they would read back why he was in the court, they would have the cops come up there and read testimony. They're like, this is what his act was. But they would just read the curse words. So this, they would go, tits, shit, cocksucker, tits, ass, cocksucker, shit. And it's like, Lenny's like, wait a minute, this is how you're going to judge my act? Can I do my act? And he made the judge allow him to do the act in court. It's like, you're completely taking these words out of context. And if this is just like people do to Howard Stern, like people who don't know Howard Stern think he's just the judging strippers part of the show that they've seen on the E! Network. Mm-hmm. They don't know. He's speaking very satirically about life, society, politics every day. You just don't hear that part of the show. So they just judge it by the one part. It's like, no, man, it's all good.
That's the hard part. There's no filter for intelligent people. Intelligent people have to listen to the whole thing all the way through. And intelligent people would want to listen to but that's, everything becomes a filter in order to condense it and make it interesting to people.
Yeah.
And that's frightening and sad. But exactly what you're talking about, he doesn't want to stand for people just saying whatever the hell they want just because they can. But it happens, you know, not to make this too political, but it happens way too frequently, I think, in comedy.
I have a podcast called Improv for Humans. It's on the earwolf.com. Improv 4, that's the number 4, for humans. And if you go to Matt Besser, at Matt Besser on Twitter, that's where I get my suggestions from that we improvise from. So check that out.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
Thank you again. And thanks to Mike. And thanks to Matt Besser. And everybody, have a good thing. Thank you.
Good. He's straight. All right, folks, in a little bit here. Screw Ireland, folks. How about that, huh? They really bum-wrapped you, the IRA. I read about them. They're really no good. Screw the Irish. What do you say about that one? Yeah, sir. Yeah, they really give you a hard time, those Micks. How about it, folks? Screw the Irish. What do you say about that thing? Okay, a heckler in the balcony.
That's the funniest thing you've said all night, boy. That's right. Screw Ireland. Screw Ireland.
Take it easy, Buster. Let's not get out of line. It's just a little joke now.
Bust your ass. Screw Ireland. Screw Ireland.
The manager, what's going on out there?
Screw Ireland! Screw Ireland!
Get that bum off the stage! Go to the new reel! Screw the bastard Irish! Get the bobbies back, folks! Screw the Irish! They stole the grail! Back! Back to the dressing room!
He was a stricken ill.
Comedy on Vinyl is recorded at Fort Awesome Studios in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. It is produced by Mike Warden and edited by Jason Klom. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. Visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch our films, read our books, look at pictures of us, go to our websites, read things about us, etc., etc. Please make sure to subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on iTunes and rate us highly. You can also follow us on Twitter at Comedy on Vinyl or Facebook.com/Comedy on Vinyl. Also, please be sure to subscribe to our latest podcast, which is called Looking Forward, a Hope Moir. In case you can't spell that, just look it up on StolenDress.com. It is the audiobook of my first book that came out in 2008, and the audiobook we released just last year. So please, yeah, check it out. It's free. I think it's pretty funny. It's going to be rolling out over the next couple months. And yeah, the whole thing will be there. Thank you so much, and have a great thing.